Thank you. We probably... Actually, I've told you everything I know, and it's very difficult, you know, to dream up something. Very hard to do. At the end of this particular lecture, why, we will consign a name on an in-think. But right now, we will tell you something about the handling, care, and control of in-thinks. Okay? There's some of you could use this. The hardest thing in the world to process is a child. Why? Because he's out of communication. That's why. Let's take a very factual look amongst us Scientologists. If anybody is not a dyed-in-the-wool Scientologist in the audience, just omit the next hour of lecture. While I am not going to use very technical terminology, I would stretch your credulity if you had not seen this. Now, I spoke of past lives. We call them past lives, not reincarnations. Why do we call them past lives? Because they're past lives. Why don't we call them reincarnations? I don't know what a reincarnation is, neither do you. But there are a lot of words connected with it. But a life span could be considered to be a period of isness, identified and located. A period of isness, identified and located. Now, when you have a period of isness, this is not quite the same as existence. You know, something can exist without being. You know, this lectern up here can exist. It is existing, you might say, but it has no awareness thereof. So therefore, a period of a life carries with it the connotation of having some remote idea that it is going on. And this is a bit better than existence. Well, we have a Scientology term. We say something is. The oddity is this, that these spooks that haunt people, every once in a while somebody is haunted by the image of his dead mother, or haunted by the image of his past wife, or so on. When he sits around and mourns the dear departed in any way, he is to some degree haunted with the image of that person, which is no longer there in person, don't you see? What he is regretting is the absence of an isness. Well, now, how does he come about regretting the absence of an isness? Mama is no longer there, so he now regrets that Mama isn't. Well, there's this oddity about it. The absence could only take place if it originally was. Now, you don't own, at this moment, a great deal of London, really, as you sit here. And if part of it were to disappear, you wouldn't miss it. This is one of the bones of contention of Scientology, I think. You wouldn't miss it. Therefore, the simple statement of loss is meaningless unless one had to begin with. Now, if you own Trafalgar Square, lock, stock, and barrel, and it got turned over as repayment on Lend-Lease... Somebody's kidding you, by the way, about the repayment of Lend-Lease. The whole American public is mad because no Lend-Lease or interest or anything is ever paid, you see. And all of the nations that have had some Lend-Lease are telling everybody they're broke because they have to pay. The American public's never heard about it. And so we sort of get the idea that this must be a political football of some kind or another. Nations are not above using these footballs. Very probably the U.S. Treasury is lying to the president and the rest of the people about the repayment of any lend-lease repaid just to keep its balances straight. Now, there's something on both ends of this, but here we have Trafalgar Square. We own it lock, stock, and barrel, and one day, a bunch of U.S. trucks come up and they carry it off, and it disappears. After that, we keep going by there saying, well, there was Trafalgar Square. Now, everybody in London, to some degree, owns a bit or a piece of Trafalgar Square. Why? Have you been there? Familiar? A landmark? Orientation point? A point from which you can view things? You would be very startled if somebody came along and put up a sign on Trafalgar Square saying, private property, keep out. Wouldn't you? That's right. All right, now, but supposing, as you own it, it disappears, well, you then miss it. You mourn for it a little bit. You say, well, Trafalgar Square, good place. How'll I ever get another pigeon pie, you know? And it's gone now. What is your consideration? Your consideration is that it was, and so we get the whole manifestation of stuck on the time track. Why? Granting beingness, we understand something about. But how about granting isness? This is something new. The memory of mother, or an aunt, or Trafalgar Square, is painful only when one granted any of these things isness. One said, it is. Now he recognizes that it isn't. So isn'tness is real only when compared to isness. Right? All right, let's take a hypothetical glue factory where they ship horses out on the outskirts someplace that thee and me never saw, we don't use as a landmark, we have nothing to do with, we don't own any of the stock in the glue factory, we don't belong to the Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals and Horseshoers. And so, we hear that this factory has been torn down and destroyed and will be never more. Meaningless. We never granted it any isness, so we don't have any isn'tness. Follow that? Well, here's an odd exercise. You know exactly, I'm sure, what I'm talking about. But let's take an exercise here. I'm not getting into a processing session here. But think of somebody who was, that you used to know, not necessarily somebody departed or dead, but just somebody you used to know. Got that? You all got somebody you used to know now? All right. Now get the idea of granting isness to that person out in front of you. Can you do that easily?
Yeah.
All right. Do you get the feel that goes along with it? They sort of exist again a little bit, don't they? Now, a Thetan does this all the time, otherwise he never has anything. It would just be a total zero across the boards, as far as havingness is concerned, if he didn't from time to time go along granting this isness. But having granted isness, he apparently never knows when to quit. And he gets himself granting isness, whereas some other agreements now say that it isn't. So it's an invalidation of himself that mother or an aunt or Trafalgar Square are no longer there. To some tiny degree, he is still granting these things isness. And all other considerations say they aren't. Now, in view of the fact that a Thetan does nothing quite as well as survive, he does this beautifully. Every time he grants an isness, he has a tendency to grant a lot of survival with it. So he gets continuing isness, which, when it discontinues, then invalidates his postulate. Thus he feels lacking in power. He feels downscale. He feels sad. Saw his mother going around, whipping up food, keeping the house straight, keeping things running, and then she disappears. He was granting her a lot of isness. And the two or three little times when it looked like she was going to go into isn'tness, he granted her a lot of continuing isness. See? You know, he says, Mother will go on living. Mother will continue to survive. You know? Mother is continuingly. And all of a sudden, Mother isn't. An invalidation of self, isn't it? But if he had never granted any isness, he would then have no invalidation of self because of it. So a lot of people, when they get way down tone scale, solve this by never granting any isness to anything and wonder why they can't see anymore. Do you follow that? They no longer do this trick because it's too painful. They have developed another postulate. They say, well, why own anything? Because I'll just lose it. And if I lose it, it will make me very sad. And I don't want to be sad anymore. What they're saying is, I don't like to have my postulates invalidated. And we get this whole matter of continuing isness, which is existence, which is present time. Present time is simply a continuing isness, which you are repetitively granting. And then in some tricky way, conceiving that it is granting you something. You see? Now, present time could exist to a marked degree without your participation in it, but when you participate in it, you grant it isness. You say it will continue. That's why people feel so bad about things like radiation. They say, here's a potentiality that can wipe out all of the isness I'm granting, and therefore, this potentiality is a potentiality of invalidation of all of my isnesses granted on this sphere in this series of lives or whatever I'm doing here. Therefore, everybody feels bad about it. No more track. No future isness. Invalidation of all postulates. The genetic line, and those who are not too familiar with Scientology and so forth, please omit the next few sentences, because I have to tell you a fact. E-meter test on random groups of Homo sapiens demonstrates reaction on the lost planets because of radiation. Demonstrates in the genetic line the loss of planet after planet after planet after planet after planet because radiation appeared on the scene. I'd never mention very much about this if it didn't influence two things very intimately, and one was children. And the other thing is the feeling we all have toward radiation, the reaction which it causes. Just as an experiment, put somebody on a detector, or even a police lie detector, something as elementary as that, and just ask them about, this person knows nothing about radiation, he's not even worried about A-bombs, something. Ask him if he ever lost a planet because of radiation. And you get the needles falling off the pins. And you say, how many? And you eventually can get some tremendous number. Now, you could ask him at the same time, have you ever lost any oceans? And you would get no reaction. You could ask him, have you ever lost any cats? And you'd get just a little twitch, you know? So it's a real heavy reaction, which is unmistakable. And we have to take this into account, because what are we looking at? We're looking at a genetic line reaction. And it says, radiation equals no planet. When radiation appears, the planet goes. That is what people think. That's what electrical thought detector devices of any type would tell you they think. That is what seems to add up. Radiation appears, planet goes. If radiation occurs, the planet will be destroyed. Man is, or other life forms coming up the genetic track. It's kind of odd apologizing about past lives because I don't know how the biologist ever accounts for the idea of evolution if he doesn't grant the idea that the organism has lived before. This would be quite tricky. If he does explain it in any other fashion, he must explain it in such a tricky fashion that it is incomprehensible indeed. Where does he think this blueprint called the human body comes from if it isn't stored someplace? You mean the fellow throws the blueprints away and the next time he builds something, why, he gets that set of blueprints back. This postulates an archives 8,000 miles straight up on cloud 9.9. Now, maybe such an archives could exist, but actually there is a much more thorough way to look at it and say that the genetic blueprint is simply carried by the individual. And part of this genetic blueprint tells us this incredible fact that the genetic line is not devoted entirely and completely and only to this planet, but embraces many other planets and much other activity in the field of radiation. Therefore, we are actually being very cagey and not being entirely truthful when we say, well, we're not quite sure why we have this amount of reaction on radiation, because we are quite sure. Any one of you could make this exact experiment, and you would discover this, that lives, series of, became impossible in the appearance of radiation. Radiation says no future, and it says it genetically. It said there will be no future mock-ups on this track. Go find another planet, if you can, and develop it from the state of barbarism up to a state of dinosaurs, if you can. Take it from lichen and moss and run it all the way up the long and tedious path of millions of years. Spend another half million years lying on the beach of some ammonia sea trying to find out how to walk. That's what this says, so that's a very serious thing. Life looks at it rather tiredly. Doesn't like it. And you get a tremendous charge on the subject of survival the moment that radiation shows up. So that the genetic line becomes so dispersed and so upset that it starts to branch out inside the organism itself, and that is cancer. The various cells of the organism say, well, it's all up with this track. I'll strike out for myself. And they develop some sort of birth organism of some kind or another, and there they go. And you get a cancerous growth, and that is cancer. That's all there is to cancer. Strike out for myself. It's a revolt in the body by a cell which is going forward on its own developmental line. In other words, it's anticipating this occurrence of no more planet. All right. Children start to adapt themselves in a wild, crazy way. Anything they can think of, anything the organism can dream of, any backtrack success that was ever vaguely workable in a radioactive planet becomes readapted by the organism. Thus you get two-headed children and all sorts of other genetic monstrosities. See, they say, well, we're not quite willing to quit. We will try to make an anti- or radiation-proof body. And therefore, we'll build anything we can think of, and then maybe one of these forms can survive in a radioactive world. A tulip, for instance. Tulips are very highly bred, bombarded with X-rays and radiation, reverted back to the original tulip. Just bing. It said, well, I survived a long time this way, and maybe by going way back down the track to this form, maybe I'll get a hold of all of these thousands of intervening years, and I'll develop in some other fashion forward toward possible radiation and thus have a future. And you get the mechanism of going backtrack. You can expect children to suddenly appear that look like barbarians, indeed, with two-foot jaws and so forth. I mean, all kinds of oddities occur. Rather nasty picture that the scientists posed for us. But the point is that it's quite comprehensible. The moment that you put people on e-meters, study the problem, ask them the questions, what this is all about, you merely find out that all of this activity of misdirection in the genetic line is simply an effort to survive in spite of something which is always heretofore knocked the planet off. Now, possibly radiation has hit this planet before. A friend of mine at the Explorers Club told me about going down through 7 layers of civilization in a cave. He got down to pots and shards, and down below that to just nothing. And then through the last strata, green glass, just exactly the kind of green glass that now covers a quarter of a mile of desert out in the middle of New Mexico after the first A-bomb explosion. Sand turns into this green glass. I found this in the Middle East some time ago. It's quite interesting. Little oddities, a possibility that radiation has appeared before on this planet. But the E-meter tells you, for whatever it's worth, well, it's fairly valid. They hang men with it. Its value is good enough so that a police respirator and electronic impulse counter and pulse-ometer hung together, if they say he did the crime, they generally put a rope around his neck and let him dance the jig. You see, so that's the kind of evidence we're talking about. We do have that evidence by asking these questions. So this says to us that the appearance of radiation deflects or deranges the genetic line. And the types of derangement come under the category of trying to find a type of organism to survive, and each cell, you might say, is liable to get some different idea from any other cell. And so you get strange cancers that nobody can explain, types of cancer nobody's ever heard of before. You get all sorts of growths and misdirections. You get all sorts of babies that look peculiar and do peculiar things and so on. In other words, it's just life in general, and that isn't some detached thing. It's just a bunch of thetans in general are trying, like mad, to find some way through this problem. And these aberrations, monstrosities, and illnesses are their cures or solutions, which might possibly work out. At least that's the way we can theorize on it, because the theory works in practice. One of the most effective processes to run upon this particular thing, by the way, is simply this one. You understand that the reason they do this is because they're convinced there's going to be no future. They're convinced there's going to be no future planet. And they're so afraid of that that they try these other things. It isn't that radiation does anything to anybody. You see? It's the fear that it will. Listen, if they blew down all the buildings in London and New York and Washington, and if we still had some food, and we could still swing an axe or a hammer and a saw, we would probably put some good cities back together again. You see? But the sudden aspect of disaster, as sweeping as atomic fission, convinces people that they no longer have the energy to build that civilization on that earth before. And is this failure which they're looking at not the actual effect of radiation at all? Now I'm talking about the mental reaction to radiation as demonstrated by an E-meter. And it has taken us into some peculiar fields of research, believe me. But we have a premise which works, and we have this process. Look around and tell me what will be here in another 10 minutes. And you just let the fellow do this, and he only tells you things he's absolutely sure will still be here in 10 minutes. And then graduate him to a half an hour, and then graduate him to an hour, and then graduate him. You find out most people, you say, what would be here tomorrow? Tell me something that would be here for sure tomorrow morning. You're absolutely convinced it would be here tomorrow morning. It's quite interesting. They very seldom find anything. You know, they just go, duh. You haven't got that much future. And we get the phenomenon of building up and increasing one's certainty of future. And as soon as he starts increasing certainty of future, the next thing he knows, he has a tremendous potential survival. And that is all he's working on. He's not working on what's going to happen to him. He's merely working on how much survival does he have, and he uses signs and symbols such as radiation, the cost of living, how nice his wife is to him, or husband is to her, to tell how much survival he has. In other words, he's got a tremendous number of signs and symbols worked out that tell him how much survival he has. We walk through the office, and the boss looks at us. And we say, I haven't got much survival, have I? Now, we walk through the office again, and the boss says, how are you, Jenks? Let's come out and have some tea. The guy says, survival, terrific. Boss and I, just like that. That's me on top. Music hall joke. Anyhow, look at this. A person is using other things than himself to tell him continually how much survival he has, how much future there is, and eventually something tells him there is none, and he believes it. The fool. Do you know this is good enough so that you get a person very, very anatin, very unconscious, you know, way down under. If you were to whisper to him quietly, you know you just died, he probably would. Sounds silly, but it's for true. I've had people report this to me, knowing what happens in Dianetics, that this has happened in operating rooms. Well, the fellow won't live through it. I doubt he'll live a half an hour after the operation, and right on the button, a half an hour after the operation, the guy's dead. Doctor says, you see, I was right. No, he wasn't. His postulate worked. Now, therefore, future is out of our control, we think. But it isn't ever. Because the truth of the matter is you might get thrown down tone scale. They might ball you up in a black ball of mud, like a biologist would like to tell you you were when you first dug out of it, which you weren't. That's akin to the Egyptian theory of a scarab. The modern scientific theory was actually adapted from the scarab, I think. Did you ever watch scarabs? Well, they bring life out of little balls of mud. So they actually, the whole Egyptian civilization thought that a ball of mud was the beginning of life. And that became modern scientific thought, of course. You think I'm wrong. You better look this up. All right. That's where this mud to man theory began. Now, we take this idea of no future and we get a person on a collapsed present time. Now, it's a very funny thing to collapse present time, but it can be done. The less future a fellow has, the less present time he has. And it works like this. The fellow who is alert and can do things and has lots of things has a present time of several seconds wide. At least several seconds. See, the distance from past to future is several seconds wide. This is the way it looks to him. Therefore, he has time to act. Therefore, he can act. Several seconds. He doesn't just pinpoint time, you know. But as he begins to lose future, and as his past begins to seem discreditable to him, he gets to have a millisecond present time. Just a millisecond, you know, not even that. It's awfully thin. Everything else starts to look thin, too. This is a description of it, no more. This is not a fact. But it is true that he doesn't have much present time, you see. So you ask him to come to present time, and it's not even there. It's so narrow that he couldn't find it even if he got on it. He goes above and below it a second or two, and it worries him, it haunts him. A man who is planning, who isn't planning several seconds ahead of the event, isn't in several seconds ahead of the event, doesn't make very good plans. Best thing to do is to plan it all out and then have it happen and have that all happen simultaneously. You If you're going to turn a car around a difficult corner, the best thing to do is to turn it all the way around the corner so that you can turn it all the way around the corner. You see? Of course, if you're really driving, you're simply izzing positions of a car. If you go around a corner, why, the car is on this part, it is on that part, it is around the corner, see? Hey, if you're really doing this well. Well, we get this idea and phenomenon of a narrow or non-existent present time. Now, what happens then as a person loses future? He certainly gets crowded in the present. He says there is no time, and boy, that is awfully close to being true. Therefore, his havingness is tremendously reduced. Therefore, he gets no benefit from present time, even if he got into it. Why? Because he has no future. And the whole subject of radiation is bound up in this idea of no future. And all you have to do is get somebody to change his mind any way you can, that he has a future, that there is something in the future. Get him to tolerate something on the future track that won't be painful or dreadful to him, and he recovers from all these odd little bits and pieces of strange phenomena. But that tells us that the child who is born and who looks and sounds sort of idiotic, and there'll be Lord knows how many of them in the next 10 years, won't be auditable by old standards. So we've got to have a new method of auditing entirely that will give them a future. And if we could give them enough future, they'd go back to battery and build right. You see that? As soon as they felt there was some future, why, they changed their mind and changed the structure. So there's a chance of saving these things. We've already processed mongoloid idiots, done things with them. Well, we can do it better today. Much, much, much better today. Because we can process a tiny baby, and not with any esoteric method. Of course, Scientologists, I always am tremendously, well, really very pleased with them, the way they handle children. The way they handle their own is sometimes disgraceful. When they're low on control, why, they adopt the old child psychology idea that the child should be able to do anything, walk over any guest, and do anything else, you see. And they think this is letting the child have his own self-determinism. Well, it doesn't work. The child is unhappy. You have to run a child from about tone 40. And if you do, why, you got it made. But when they have the little tiny babies, it's quite amazing. A Scientologist has a completely worked out regimen, evidently, of how he goes about raising a child, which, by the way, he was never particularly taught. He just evolves this out of Scientology. And it consists of this. He makes the baby part of the family at once. And he starts talking to the baby. He usually makes very, very sure that the baby didn't have a rough passage prenatally, had a decent and easy birth. This is always very hard on medicos. They're very difficult for medicos. They get upset. You get quite upset because Scientology mothers have babies so easy and don't make any fuss out of it, and the babies get along so well and progress so rapidly that it's very upsetting to their prediction. And I've had several of them complain to me directly that I was ruining their trade. It's getting down to a point where he didn't need a doctor. Usually it's all over before the doctor gets there, you know. They have a few contractions and they have the baby and then eat breakfast, you know. It's really, I'm not drawing an incorrect picture now. I'm drawing a rather correct one. Now, child arrives, and the normal thing they tell the child is, well, how are you? Glad you're here. You're welcome to the mock-up. Pick it up and get it going, you know. You'd think offhand that this would simply be fond parental belief that the child was answering up, but it isn't. It isn't. It's amazing. You tell a little baby, if you're its parent, we're going to keep you. It's okay. We're going to keep you. And you always get a... They're so happy about that. It's such a relief to them. They feel like a thief before that time, you see. Now, you suppose they've forgotten the English language and everything connected with it and everything connected with living as if they ever lived before. And so they appear to have done. So they appear to have done. But Nibby's new baby is quite interesting this way. Nibby, taking some flash pictures of the baby, walked around and turned around to Debbie, little baby, and he says, now I'm going to take a picture of you, and this thing is going to flash real bright. It isn't going to hurt you. Debbie looks at him, takes a picture, and says, okay, you know. Does this two or three times, and you'd think offhand, you know, that, a child doesn't ordinarily cry when he sees a flash bulb go off anyhow. Oh, doesn't he? So anyhow, brought Debbie over to the house. I was taking some pictures of the kids. I didn't say a word to Debbie, and I flashed the flash bulb. And Debbie went, meow! Boo-hoo, boo-hoo, boo-hoo. Nibby came in and said, you didn't tell her. Now, Debbie, that was just a flash bulb. He wasn't trying to hurt you. It's all right. Debbie looked at him, shut up. Of course, we're talking now about a 2 and 3 weeks old baby. Now, I know that babies talk long before they talk. I had a baby once that used to, at the age of about a month, something like that, was saying hello and daddy and a lot of other things. But what is the exact state of this child that we're going to process? Now, by golly, it's all due well and good to say parascientology and this and that, but you're facing the actuality of a radioactive world which may have no more future than a rabbit if we don't get busy. Therefore, let's establish the reality of some of these facts to our own satisfaction and not cuff them anymore. Either they're true or they're not true. And amongst these facts is that when a baby comes in, that is to say, you have a baby, a thetan picks up that mock-up right at birth, they do. You can find this engram on the track. That thetan has just got through living a life. And he could speak a language, and he could do this, and he could do that, and he had a trade and a profession, and he had every other doggone thing you could shake your stick at. But he lost a body, and the havingness of that body was what he depended on to tell him that he had anything. And when he lost it, he thought he lost all of his skills. And he went way down tone scale. And you're not processing a clear, new being when you're processing a baby. You're processing somebody who is just shaken to bits, has just been through a fabulously difficult and upsetting experience that it's going to take him years to get over. Thus, we get the anxieties of childhood. We can no longer afford to buy the romantic lies of other days, which told us that in child behavior we saw the primitive. That actually child behavior was native and natural behavior, which if we didn't stamp all over hard, would be how all of us would act. Listen, that is the most vicious philosophy that was ever released on the face of earth. A fellow has just lost a body. He just lost his Morris. His studs. The painting Joanne gave him. His slippers. And even his knowledge of where Church Street crosses Notting Hill Gate. He's at it. And if right here at this moment you lost everything you had, not including a body, you would feel upset, wouldn't you? Well, now add a body to it. Now that's the state a little baby's in and why he doesn't have any better luck orienting a body fast. And this tells you why he doesn't play calmly. This tells you why he has a short span of attention. This tells you why he's racked to bits by various things which startle him, why he feels unsafe, why he wants to hang on to Mama and Papa, and why when they swear at him or something like that, he feels absolutely shattered. He's been disenfranchised of life, and he's pleading for a small door back in. And until he gets the mass of a fairly adult body, he doesn't feel secure. He only then comes back into possession of a few things that he lost. He gets a better Morris. At first he sort of doesn't want it, but maybe you get it, you know. He gets some more slippers. He gets another girlfriend. But there's a lot of sadness and nostalgia mixed up in it that isn't native to him. This isn't just the way things are. All of a sudden this girl meets this beautiful man, you know. Gee. And all of a sudden she felt, duh. What's the matter with me? Well, it's inexplicable. That's just life. That's the way love is. Oh, is it? No, this fellow she just met re-stimulated the guy she lost 20 years ago. Only she now lost him so much she doesn't even know she lost him, and that does her more damage than knowing she lost him. It is the unknown that bites. It is the unknown valence that is the difficult one to handle. Can't understand why you don't like Bill. You just can't understand why you don't like Bill. Well, Bill looked exactly like your old man in your last life. See? That's absolutely fantastic. What chance has Bill got? Thus, human relations go all askew if we continue to live out, and in Scientology too, admit this lie that we all live once, that the child is the primitive, native way people are. Another bunk. It isn't true. A little kid is in terrible condition. That he can function as well as he functions. That he can manage enough, as much affection as he can manage. That he tries as hard as he does try and lives as well as he does live is a terrific tribute to the ability and ability to bounce back of a fate. Now, when you look at children from that standpoint, you would recognize that a point of processing could theoretically be reached where a child of 4 or 5 would have poise and dignity and a long span of attention and all the hope of growing up too, and that would be quite a child. The difficulties of learning how to control a body are overwhelming because one has to have the environment sort of mold the body into control. Now, do we have any processes? Well, I told you Scientologists talk to them. Good, nothing wrong with that. I came in one time and I saw somebody, Scientologist had a new baby and he was sitting on the edge of the crib, and as I walked in the door he went this way at me. Step back, you know, don't. And he says, all right now. He says, go back to the beginning of birth. And I watched this, and without any acknowledgement or reply from the child, he was running the birth engram out from the beginning. And this was only about 3-4 days after delivery. And he was just running it, standard old book one engram, doing well at it. So the child was just lying there, apparently, doped off. All of a sudden, why, the baby says, that's right, he says, now, he says, go to the point where the doctor grabbed you. And the baby says, what? He says, now, you don't have to dramatize. He says, run it. And the baby's head shape changed and got quite normal. Now, here we're dealing with not very much mystery, but here we're dealing with a lot of understanding, which if we apply it, we really get somewhere. And we have a process today with control, which will, if the auditor is well indoctrinated, boy, that is the reservation. If the auditor is very well indoctrinated, he better not try to use these upper scale processes because he'll flinch somewhere along the line just at the wrong moment. But an indoctrination is very easy to do. So, we take this situation of a catatonic schiz, flat out, motionless, no reaction. If you shoved a match into her foot, she wouldn't wiggle. Breath barely perceptible, almost a case of suspended animation, hopelessly insane. And we today can audit her right straight up the line, so easy, you'll be ashamed of yourselves for not having torn the doors off of these insane asylums before. How do we do it? Obviously, this catatonic schiz cannot control her body. Doesn't want to, has no cognition, recognition, or anything else. Completely plunged out of sight, dead gone, you got it? Now, how many days you would have to do this, or the length of time you would do this, are determined by the case. But you would come along, and you would not depend on the preclear to talk to you, to audit the preclear. Now, the silly one of this would be to simply audit out an engram without doing anything else, but you could not be sure that the preclear was following your directions. So this would not necessarily be the optimum condition. We do something much simpler but much tougher on the auditor. He does tone 40, handshake. He says, give me your hand, at which time he picks up the person's hand, or forearm, and puts the hand in his. And he says, thank you, and drops the hand. He picks up the person's arm, he puts the hand in his, as he says, give me your hand, shakes it, says, thank you. Give me your hand. Thank you. Now, after a while, he lets a lag occur in here. He says, give me your hand, and picks up the hand and shakes it. But he waits an instant before he picks up the hand. He says, give me your hand. Then he sees definitely that this is not at once going to happen by the person. So he does pick up the arm and puts the hand in his and says, thank you. He doesn't answer anything. He doesn't acknowledge anything. If the person did speak or scream or do anything else, he would not say or do anything else than just this exercise. And that is almost, it sounds utterly impossible to an auditor. First crack out of the box, running this on a psycho, tears all over the room, screams, he throws things and so forth. Give me your hand. Thank you. You get fooled by the same preclears. St. Preclear says, just a minute. Boy, have I got a cognition. Give me your hand. Thank you. How would you pay no attention to origin? You have to know all about origin and be clear to the top at tone 40 before you can ignore it. So don't just stop ignoring. If you're auditing at a lower level, you've got to answer up. So we take this catatonic schiz and we say, give me your hand, and then we put the person's hand in ours, we shake hands, we then say thank you, acknowledging the action, and as we keep it up, we will eventually first get a tiny reflexive pressure by the person. Tiny pressure. They press a little bit. And eventually, they will sneak that hand down and put it in your hand. You are no longer picking up the arm. Eventually, they're putting out their hand to you. You say, well, according to old conditioning, a person would do this if he was conditioned into doing this over a long enough period of time. Well, then why didn't somebody make catatonic schizes as well before? Because it's never been done. No, it isn't a machine. You're waking up. You're asking a thetan to take over control of his body by demonstrating to him that in a very high-toned way, he can command and order and control that body. And you're giving him the model and showing him it can be done. And that's all you're doing, showing him it can be done. Well, it's necessary for you to know that. This takes care of a case of coma. Somebody's been lying in coma for 3 or 4 weeks or something on this order. They're liable to die. And you can snap them back in this fashion. You continue to run it long after they're talking with you, by the way. You don't try to run something else. And eventually, after you finish the short auditing period and so forth, they'll have a discussion with you about it somehow or another. Perfectly all right. But you don't just dock off the process. That is the process that woke them up and the process that will carry them quite a ways up the track. Now do you see why I'm telling you about this process? Not because we have anything much to do with psychos. But we could today. Definitely, you test this one out after you've got yourself knocked into shape, and you'll think that this is very good, I'm sure. This is only one of a half a hundred control mechanisms of this same nature, so you might as well experiment on it as any other. But it happens because it combines the reality line, which I was telling you about. See, it makes a line. And they can recognize the line. It does happen to be rather good. There are many others that are almost as good. All right. Now, how about a little kid? How about a baby? Same thing. Little kid has a nightmare. Wakes up screaming. You say, that's an awful time for an auditing session. So you put him back to bed again. You say, go to sleep. He won't go to sleep. He's scared stiff. He's totally disoriented. Well, I'm afraid about the third time you put him back to bed after he wakes up screaming, you decide 4 o'clock in the morning, it's a hell of a time for an auditing session, you give him one. How do you give it to him? He's screaming. He's trying to get away from you. He's trying to back up against the wall. He's trying to do everything he can do to stop you. Therefore, the auditors with all 5 levels of INDOC run this easily and well, and auditors who haven't had it don't run it at all. Quit. All right. They'd have to buck themselves into this one way or the other, which is totally possible. All right. Now, we have this little kid, and he's screaming. He's withholding his hand. He's trying to put his hands behind his back. He's kicking with his feet, doing everything else. And your tendency might be to use too much force on him, to use too little force on him, to talk to him harshly, or to try to talk to him sharply so as to get his attention. And you'd just be missing the gun in all directions. Tone 40, give me your hand. Thank you. 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 20 minutes, half an hour, all of a sudden, you're giving him a chance to actually give it to you before you take care of it, you see, before you take hold of it. Give me your hand. You see he's not going to. Just a little split second in there. All of a sudden, he gives you his hand. Gives you his hand. All of a sudden, laughs. Puts his arms around you, gives you a kiss. Goes back to sleep, perfectly happy. Wakes up the next morning, feeling fine. He found a circuit full blown and you blew it. It isn't just a temporary measure. You'll have this little kid after a relatively short space of time. We all know that a child has an attention span of 10 or 15 seconds, and at the most, 10 or 15 minutes. We know this. This we know. Well, damn it, we'd better not know it so well. Because it's a mighty poor look at sanity that a person can only concentrate on something for 10 or 15 minutes. He can only handle a toy long enough to break it. He gets bored. He gets upset. He can't direct himself. He doesn't want to obey. He doesn't want to do this. He doesn't want to do that. No, no, no. This is aberrated conduct. This isn't normal. Might be normal for the child in this age and time when we're all too impatient and it's too expensive to have a child. But the score on this is 100% if it's done well. What processes will he graduate up to for how long? That becomes the important question. It has not been very fully looked into. But I can tell you, you can have the child very shortly doing tone 48C. Hour after hour after hour. Nice as you please. Coming upscale all the time. Child begins to treat you in an entirely different fashion. Quite interesting. Good evening, Daddy. How are you? Sounds strange from a 4 or 5-year-old child. What a lovely dress you have on, Mother. Sounds like you've robbed them of their childhood. Well, from what I've seen of most childhoods is jolly well time somebody did. There we have it. As far as child auditing is concerned, I'm looking at people here who've done quite a bit of child auditing. It's taken me a long time to shake this one out of a hopper. But the moment that a Scientologist discovered that he was not creating blasphemy or something the moment he touched his preclear with his hands, the moment he found out that he could get away with this, the moment we started to get away with this, we were no longer dependent on the preclear answering up when we spoke. We were no longer dependent upon a verbal line to make the preclear respond. And the moment we were no longer dependent upon a verbal line, we reached the reality of a minus tone scale theta. When I first started auditors in on this, mauling and manhandling preclears, you know, look at the wall. We've been doing this over here for some little time. Look at the wall, you know. Preclear look at you and say, yes, you're saying. All right. Walk over to it, and the preclear would say, I don't feel like it, you know. There were some auditors that almost fainted with the horror of it. They didn't like that a bit. And I saw one of them who protested at the time, auditing somebody the other day without knowing it at all. Person had gotten so well accustomed to handling people, had protested the time this first came out. He was putting a person through the door. And they were just walking out together, you know. The auditor took hold of the other person, put him through the door. You know, moved him aside, moved him into the door, moved him out of the door. And they were just going on talking. They got on down the street and they ran into some kind of an obstruction, and the other one who had been moved through the door reached over and picked out the auditor and moved him around the obstruction. And the beautiful joke of it is neither one of them noticed it or paid much attention to it. They're perfectly willing to run each other's bodies, and both of them getting along beautifully, by reason why. Do you see that this could be different? Well, the moment that we were no longer dependent on a child saying, yes, I want a session. We could audit them. And so we're auditing them these days. But I give you this word of warning, that a child particularly takes much higher toned auditing, tone porting, before you try anything like this. And if after you've started an auditor preclear relationship with a child, then what you say and do to the child has much more effect on the child for quite a while. So mama who starts to audit little Georgie has become Georgie's auditor. And when mama raps out at little Georgie and says, you little idiot, Georgie, before he's up-toned to a point where he can stand in comparable relation to mama, takes it as a total invalidation of case. Doesn't make him worse, but it sure makes him feel bad. Whereas he might be able to develop no effect in armor plate toward his parents when they're auditing him, he doesn't. They therefore find it necessary to respond on a fairly high tone toward the child thereafter when they start this. But you know it's easier? There's no reason wrestling with a child unless you like to wrestle. And if you like to wrestle, go find a bear and wrestle with him. If you want to scold something, get a particularly, peculiarly ignorant dog that can never learn anything anyhow that you have to run yourself and just keep him around to scold. But if you're running a child, he can run all the way up the scale. He can get into beautiful condition. And then you could probably chop at him all you wanted to because he'd understand that you just weren't feeling well or something of the sort. His understanding would be up to taking it. Well, we have this subject in pretty good shape now. And I hope it, too, will be of some use to you. Thank you.